This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, The Visionary of Trump 2.0 by McKay Coppins. The opening act of Donald Trump's second term was defined by the theatrical dismantling of much of the federal government by Elon Musk and his group of tech-savvy demolitionists. Everywhere you looked in those first 100 days, it seemed, Musk's prestidigitation was on display. Look there, it's Elon in a black MAGA hat waving around a chainsaw on stage at the Conservative Political Action Conference. Look here, it's Elon introducing Fox News viewers to a teenage software engineer nicknamed Big Balls, whom he'd hired to help slash the government. The performance had a certain improvised quality. Pink slips dispersed and then hastily withdrawn, entire agencies mothballed overnight. And after a while, it started to feel like a torqued-up sequel to Trump's first term, governance replaced by chaos and trolling. But that version of the story misses a key character, Russell Vought. Behind all the Doge pyrotechnics, Vought, who serves as the director of the Office of Management and Budget, is working methodically to advance a sophisticated ideological project decades in the making. If Musk is moving fast and breaking things, as the Silicon Valley dictum goes, Vought is taking the shattered pieces of the federal government and reassembling them into a radically new constitutional order. I'm not going to say it's a misdirection play, but they're the trauma-inducing shock troops, Steve Bannon, who worked with Vought during Trump's first term and remains in touch with him, told me of Doge. Russ has got a vision. He's not an anarchist. He's a true believer. Vought's agenda includes shrinking the government, but it goes deeper than that. His vision of state power would effectively reject a century of jurisprudence and unravel the modern federal bureaucracy as we know it. A devotee of so-called unitary executive theory, he wants to see the civil service gutted and repopulated with presidential loyalists, independent federal agencies politicized or eliminated, and absolute control of the executive branch concentrated in the Oval Office. Despite having been a Trump advisor for nearly a decade, Vought has not cultivated the political celebrity of high-profile White House officials such as Stephen Miller and Carolyn Leavitt. Vought rarely gives interviews. He declined my request. And when he does speak in public, he is usually explicating the intricacies of the federal government in a nasal voice. His job title is dull and opaque. Even his physical bearing is forgivable. Bald and bespeckled, with a graying beard, he looks a bit like a middle school social studies teacher. But whereas Musk's influence already seems to be waning, Vought remains among the most powerful figures in today's Washington. As a co-author of Project 2025, and later a chair of the Republican National Convention's Platform Committee, he drew up detailed plans to, quote, tame the bureaucracy, end quote, once Trump returned to power. Now, as head of an agency that touches every aspect of the $6.8 trillion federal budget, Vought is in a position to enact his vision. And he's wasted little time. In his early days as acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an independent agency that was designed to be insulated from partisan pressure, Vought sent layoff notices to 1,500 employees, closed the office, canceled contracts, and declined funding for the agency from the Federal Reserve. Across hundreds of other federal agencies, he is spearheading an effort to simply stop enforcing many regulations. And last month, Trump proposed a rule that would convert 50,000 federal workers into Schedule F employees, whom the president can fire at will, a policy that Vogt has championed since the first term. Vogt's ideas, once seen as radical, are now being realized. Vogt's critics have warned that elements of his agenda, for example, unilaterally cutting off funding for congressionally established agencies such as USAID, are eroding checks and balances and pushing the country toward a constitutional crisis. But in interviews over the past several weeks, some of his allies told me that's the whole point. The kind of revolutionary upending of the constitutional order that Vogt envisions won't happen without deliberate fights with Congress and the judiciary, they told me. If a crisis is coming, it's because Vogt is courting one. Bannon told me that mainstream Republicans have long complained about runaway federal bureaucracy, but have never had the stomach to take on the problem directly. Vogt, by contrast, is strategically enforcing confrontations with other branches of the government. What Russ represents and what the Romneys and the McConnells don't understand is that the old politics is over, he said. There's no compromise here. One side is going to win, one side is going to lose. So let's get it on. The White House did not respond to a list of questions I sent them for this story. But in a statement, Communications Director Stephen Chung called Vogt a patriot and told me, there is nobody more qualified or better suited to lead OMB in order to implement President Trump's goals and priorities. Vogt himself has written that we are living in a post-constitutional time. Progressives, he argues, have so thoroughly perverted the founders' vision by filling the ranks of government with unaccountable technocrats that undoing the damage will require a radical plan of attack. The right needs to throw off the precedents and legal paradigms that have wrongly developed over the last 200 years, he wrote in an essay for The American Mind, a journal published by the Claremont Institute. What exactly would such an approach look like in practice? Mike Davis, a Republican lawyer and friend of Vogt's, who helped steer judiciary nominations in Trump's first term, told me that he expects an escalating series of standoffs between the Trump administration and the judicial branch. He went so far as to say that if the Supreme Court issues a decision that constrains Trump's executive power in a way that the administration sees as unconstitutional, the president will have to defy it. The reptiles will never drain the swamp, Davis told me. It's going to take bold actions. Vogt's radicalization was not a foregone conclusion. He grew up in Trumbull, Connecticut, with a devout family who sent him to a private Christian school and Bible camp in the summers. At Wheaton College, the evangelical university where he studied history and political science, Vogt was bookish and a bit nerdy, according to one fellow graduate who knew him at the time. The former student, who requested anonymity to recount personal interactions, told me that Vogt was a target of periodic pranks on their floor in Traber Hall. On one occasion, some of Vogt's dorm mates took a putrid smelling bin that had been collecting dirty dishes in the common bathroom and hid it under his bed. On Wheaton's conservative campus, Vogt didn't stand out as a particularly ideological. He made a brief foray into electoral politics with a failed bid for student body vice president, during which he campaigned, according to Bloomberg Businessweek, on improving the school's recycling program. His views began to take on sharper edge when he got to Washington. He spent a decade working on Capitol Hill, including as a policy aide to House Republican Conference under then-Chairman Mike Pence, and became the executive director of the Republican Study Committee, a conservative caucus founded to exert pressure on House GOP leadership from the right. In 2010, he left Congress to join the Heritage Foundation's lobbying arm. Vogt earned a reputation in Washington's right-wing circles for his deep knowledge of how the federal government actually works. There's a category of conservative activists who say, this is what should be done, and there's a much smaller group who actually know how to make it happen. Russ is one of them. Tom Fitton, the president of the conservative pressure group Judicial Watch, told me. The early years of Barack Obama's presidency inspired a wave of libertarian energy on the right. Tea Party activists railed against excessive federal spending and bloated bureaucracy. The popular rallying cry of the moment was to shrink the government down to the size where one could drown it in a bathtub, as Grover Norquist famously put it. But Vogt wanted to go further than the Norquists of the world. After Republicans failed to recapture the White House in 2012, Vogt joined a small group of activists and operatives who began gathering a few blocks from the Capitol at the Judicial Watch offices to strategize. They called themselves Groundswell, and their stated mission, according to leaked documents, was bold if a bit grandiose, to wage a 30-front war that would fundamentally transform the nation. The weekly meetings drew a who's who of influential insurgents, including Ginny Thomas, Dan Bongino, Leonard Leo, and Bannon, who was then running Breitbart News. Their agenda was diffuse, but they were united in a shared conviction that the Republican establishment and much of the conservative movement were insufficiently radical. They were impatient with the standard small government activism of the era. They wanted more confrontation and were open to more extreme ideas. The conservative commentator Eric Erickson, who first met Vogt in 2004, recalls his friend explaining to him early in Obama's first term the mechanisms by which the purportedly nonpartisan civil service had come to be teeming with Democrats intent on thwarting right-leaning policies and pushing left-wing ones. It was a prototype of the woke and weaponized bureaucracy rhetoric that Vogt and his allies would deploy in the Trump era. The unitary executive theory had been circulating in GOP circles since at least Ronald Reagan's first term. The idea held that Article 2 of the Constitution gives the president absolute control over the executive branch, including nonpartisan civil servants and independent agencies, such as the Federal Reserve and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Republicans had periodically experimented with ways of applying this principle. After Reagan took office in 1981, the Heritage Foundation lobbied the new administration to recruit partisan supporters to fill 5,000 new jobs created by the 1978 Civil Service Reform Act. There was, during the Obama years, limited intellectual appetite on the right for a return of the imperial presidency. But Trump's arrival in the Oval Office in 2017 and his running claims that the, quote, deep state, end quote, was sabotaging his presidency changed all of that. Suddenly, Republicans were eager to discover new and creative ways to tighten the president's grip on the executive branch. Vogt, who joined the administration as deputy director of OMB before eventually becoming director, was happy to offer his services. Unlike most OMB directors, whose only foray is into political controversy, are in drafting the president's budget proposals, Vogt quietly played a role in some of the Trump era's most combustible moments. In 2019, when Trump pressured Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden, it was Vogt's office that withheld military aid to the country, eventually triggering Trump's first impeachment. And when Congress refused to fund the border wall, it was Vogt who convinced the president to declare a state of emergency so that he could redirect $3.6 billion from a military construction budget to the project. Vogt has expressed pride in his record of pushing boundaries in ways that unsettle less dogmatic Republicans. Whereas many religious conservatives distance themselves from the Christian nationalist label, Vogt wears it proudly as at a heritage event. He sarcastically derided some of the cabinet officials in Trump's first term, whom he described as a bunch of people around him who were constantly sitting on eggs and saying, "Oh my gosh, he's getting me to violate the law." In a 2023 speech at the Center for Renewing America, the think tank he led after Trump's first term, Vogt touted the virtues of cruelty as he held forth on his plans for the federal civil service. "We want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected," he said at a closed-door meeting, according to a video that was later leaked to ProPublica. When they wake up in the morning, we want them not to want to go to work because they are increasingly viewed as the villains. We want their funding to be shut down so that the EPA can't do all of the rules against our energy industry because they have no bandwidth financially to do so. We want to put them in trauma. As disruptive as Vogt's early moves have been, his most dramatic provocations are likely still to come. Vogt has been a vocal champion of reviving the presidential impoundment power, which would allow the president to effectively circumvent Congress to unilaterally withhold appropriated funds. Congress outlawed this practice in 1974, and the Supreme Court has ruled it unconstitutional. But Trump has publicly rejected this interpretation of the law, and Vogt has called impoundment a necessary remedy to our fiscal brokenness. Earlier this month, the White House released its proposed budget to Congress, calling for $163 billion in reductions to federal spending and making many of DOGE's cuts permanent. In a letter to Congress, Vogt wrote that the proposed cuts aim to root out niche non-governmental organizations and institutions of higher education committed to radical gender and climate ideologies antithetical to the American way of life. The proposal, including slashing the budget for the CDC by nearly 40%, dramatically scaling back rental assistance programs, and cutting aid to international development banks. In a typical year, the president's budget is little more than a messaging document, with virtually no chance of becoming law as written. Congress has the power of the purse. But given Trump's stated indifference to such conventions, this year's White House budget could be less a proposal than a warning shot. It doesn't require much imagination to envision how the coming budget fight could spiral into the kind of constitutional crisis that Vogt's allies are rooting for. Congress declines to enshrine Trump's spending cuts as law. Trump cuts the funding anyway. Legal challenges follow, court orders are issued, and Trump defies them, claiming a decisive mandate from voters and sweeping power under the unitary executive theory. Some conservatives, wary of concentrating so much power in the Oval Office, question the path that Vogt is taking. Philip Wallach, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, who recently wrote a book called Why Congress, told me that he generally supports Vogt's efforts to rein in the so-called administrative state, but he is alarmed by what he considers to be Vogt's disregard for core constitutional principles, such as separation of powers. "For those of us who care about constitutional government," Wallach said, "this administration is creating a lot of moments of truth." Of course, partisan enthusiasm for executive power rarely outlasts the loss of the White House. But Vogt's allies trust that he knows what he's doing. He's mindful enough to understand that eventually a Democrat will become president again, Erickson told me. So how do you make the bureaucracy responsive to the president of the day without making it so powerful enough to work at cross purposes with conservative goals when a Democrat is in there? One of the easiest ways is to downsize. In other words, the durability of Vogt's ideological project might depend on just how much of the federal government Trump can unravel before he leaves office. Next, Quaker parents were ahead of their time, written by Gail Cornwall. One morning in 1991, I prayed with the fervor that only a tween can muster for one thing above all others, cold Diet Mountain Dew. But all the cans in my mom's stash were warm. So I tossed one in the freezer, forgot about it, and hours later retrieved the frozen solid mass. Then I decided to pop it in the microwave. You can imagine what ensued. After extinguishing the flames, my mom asked us kids what we thought had happened. I stepped forward as if approaching a gallows. She lavished me with praise for telling the truth, for taking responsibility. Her response might seem surprising, but we're Quakers, and avoiding judgment is pretty on brand. From where I stand now, I can see that her decision to use positive reinforcement aligns with research on motivating kids, something I've become quite familiar with as a journalist covering parenting and education. Still, for years I didn't recognize the connection between my faith and the child development studies I frequently combed through at work. Then, when the coronavirus pandemic temporarily left our public school without enough adults to meet my son's needs, we switched him to a Quaker school. The school is organized around an acronym I'd never heard before, SPICES. That stands for principles that I know well: simplicity, peace, integrity, community, equality, and stewardship. But those aren't the only pillars of Quakerism, but they're big ones, and seeing them all together got me thinking. Sitting in the meeting house one Sunday morning, after nearly an hour of silent worship, I had a Queen's Gambit moment. Whereas the chess champ saw pawns moving across a phantom board, I saw each child-rearing best practice I'd been writing about line up with the principle of Quakerism. The Religious Society of Friends, Quaker being a derogatory term reclaimed, is a hard faith to explain because it tries to eschew dogma. It's now possible to be a Muslim Quaker or a Hindu one, or not to believe in any god at all. That said, Quakers all over the world tend to talk about the same principles and take part in some of the same practices. For example, in place of rules, Quakers publish Advices and Queries, which prompts individuals to make good, considered choices. Attendees of Quaker meetings near me were recently asked to ponder, do I make my home a place of friendliness, joy, and peace, where residents and visitors can feel God's presence? The children's version read, in what ways am I kind to the people in my home? Certain expectations underlie these questions, that one should try to be kind, for example, but so do curiosity and an openness to differing answers. As it turns out, leading with questions is a great way for parents to talk to children. Encouraging kids to come up with their own solutions grants them autonomy. And as Emily Edlin, a psychologist and author of Autonomy-Supportive Parenting, told me, kids who feel like they have control over their life experience better emotional health, including less depression and anxiety. Fostering kids' autonomy is also tied to children building stronger self-regulation skills, doing better in school, and navigating social situations more effectively. Best of all, once kids get used to the self-discipline that comes with exercising autonomy, it can become habitual. Give your kids agency in one area and they end up to develop internal motivation even for things that they do not want to do, Edlin said, because they're integrating the understanding of the why those things are so important. It can be scary to trust children with independence, but kids are better problem solvers than some people might think. When my son, age 10, asked me if he could play laser tag with friends, I asked him how he could avoid pulling a trigger, in deference to the Quaker value of pacifism. He decided to serve as referee. I was proud of him for exercising discernment, another Quaker value, all on his own, for listening to his still small voice within, and letting it guide him to a solution that satisfied his need for belonging. He is now 13 and recently couldn't decide whether to accept a babysitting job or relax at home. I asked him, "What do you think tomorrow will you wish today you had done?" He picked out stuffed animals to give to his charges, spent the evening feeling needed, and had cash the next day when he wanted to buy boba for a friend. Obviously, real damage could come from giving kids complete autonomy, and Quakerism recognizes this. Early Quaker epistles inveigh against permissiveness, and a 1939 text, Children and Quakerism, quotes William Penn, the Quaker who founded the state of Pennsylvania, saying, "If God give you children, love them with wisdom, correct them with affection." In other words, pacifism doesn't mean that parents can't set boundaries. Quakers have a tradition known as spiritual gifts. That involves treating individual talents as assets that belong to the community and ought to be developed in ourselves and encouraged in others. For parents, this means focusing on what your children choose to do, are good at, and enjoy. You can't ignore your children's weaknesses, but you can spend less energy on them. For my youngest's terrible handwriting, that meant aiming for legibility and saving the time that could have gone toward cursive lessons for activities that animate her, such as building boats and airplanes from the contents of the recycling bin. Perhaps the most important element of Quaker parenting is the edict to let your life speak. In practice, that looks like apologizing to your kid freely, saying please and thank you, and yes, trying not to shout at them. It means acting in accordance with your values, such as when my grandma took me to pack toothbrushes and soap into kits for Kosovo, and when my kids made PB&Js for our unhoused neighbors, or bring games to a family shelter. So here I am, nearly 375 years after Quakerism's founding, asking my kids questions, giving them bounded autonomy, and nudging them to invest in their strengths and be stewards of their community, all while communicating that their worth is in no way contingent. Put together, these Quaker practices result in a parenting style considered ideal by psychologists, authoritative parenting. Authoritative parenting is characterized by the effort to warmly and responsively set limits to support kids rather than punish them harshly when they overstep these limits. I'm sorry I had to cut that article short due to time constraints, because we have run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.